This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was Lori Lightfoot, the president of the Chicago Police Board. Lori challenged over 200 people in the audience when she said, "The city, the police department, and the community needs to face some very hard truths in trying to balance between protecting individual rights and the need to keep the city safe." She said many times the majority of men and women on the Chicago Police Department need our support, and we have to give them the tools they need to succeed. She said we can support the police department and be pro-reform, and reforms will help the police department in their core mission of saving and protecting. She congratulated Superintendent Johnson for certain programs that he has instituted and augmented, including improved recruit training, in-service training that will be 40 hours annually starting in 2019, development of new early intervention tools, increased transparency. But she said there are certain areas that we still must address. Since 2011, the city has paid out over $300 million to answer to charges of police misconduct. That's $20 to $30 million annual payments that come from the taxpayers of Chicago. She asked the question, what's driving these cases? Are they rogue cops? Is it systematic failures or more? She feels that Mayor Emanuel and the law department of the city of Chicago should be asking certain questions, and she said that she has no confidence that this is happening. Every year, there are 400 to 500 excessive force allegations that have racial components. The numbers keep going up, and we need to clear some of these numbers. With regard to homicides, she said Chicago has an abysmal clearance rate, 17%. New York, L.A., clear between 60 and 70%. What that means is, if you commit a murder in Chicago, you have an 80% chance of getting away with it. Murders walk free 8 out of every 10 times. She said that the shooting in Parkland, Florida, was to be regretted, but Chicago has this virtually every month. The shootings that go on result in a huge human and monetary cost. Kids in Chicago learn to duck and cover before they learn their ABCs. Money must be spent, and the city must address the crisis that faces our city with the police department. We have to address the drivers of violence. We must become an agency for the catalyst of change. If the governor and the mayor appointed 600 leaders to get Amazon to come to Chicago, we need a task force of 600 leaders to address the problems of police, community, and violence. She concluded by saying, "The path will not be easy or comfortable, but urgency will drive us to ask what each of us can do to make a difference."
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
I like that spirit. Over 2 years ago, I stood before this august body to talk about the challenges we face in trying to heal the deep wounds exposed in the aftermath of the disclosure of the videotape depicting the tragic death of Laquan McDonald. I said then that we would only move from that very dark place if we faced some hard truths. Now, in some ways, things have changed since those dark days. But in other ways, some hard truths have yet to be addressed. It is that reality that I want to address with you today. A challenge that involves striking the right balance between protecting important individual rights with the desperate need to keep our citizens safe. To set the context for our discussion, let me say a few important introductory comments. First, I believe that the City of Chicago Police Department is one of the most important institutions in our city. The vast majority of men and women who wear that uniform bring honor to their daily duties and remain on the job for all the right reasons. The challenge is to give them the tools that they need to be successful, and defining that success in ways that recognize the need for respectful engagement with the public. I believe that the Chicago Police Department cannot be successful in its core mission of fighting crime and keeping the public safe without a constant eye on reform. And neither the efforts on reform or crime fighting will be successful without addressing some of the larger systemic challenges that CPD officers face every day. There has been a prevailing narrative here and across the country that you cannot be supportive of the police and also be pro-reform. That narrative further holds that you cannot effectively fight crime and tamp down violence while at the same time insisting upon constitutional policing. Those who hold those views say that policing is messy and it requires you to get your hands dirty, and all of this PC nonsense will not get the job done. People who believe this are in effect telling us that we need to pick a side, choose where we stand. And if you choose the side of the police, you got to shut up, get out of the way, and let the good guys get the job done. Well, I am here today to call, I'll say nonsense in this polite company, on this fake narrative and this false choice. I will argue, and I do, that without broad and deep implementation of reforms, the police department will never be successful in its core mission. But also that we set the department up for failure if we do not simultaneously address the drivers of the violence and the issues that are plaguing so many families and neighborhoods across Chicago. And let's begin by talking about the success that CPD has made in moving towards the reforms identified by both the Police Accountability Task Force and the U.S. Department of Justice, of course, pre-Trump. Under the leadership of Superintendent Johnson, progress has been made on certain important issues. Let me first talk about training. The lifeblood of reform efforts remains better and more comprehensive training for our officers. And that includes work to be done at both the academy with recruit classes as well as training for veteran officers. We can no longer tolerate a situation where an officer graduates from the academy and spends his entire career, maybe spanning 30 years, and has no further annual mandatory training other than firearms qualification. I am happy to report that the department understands this imperative and has placed a renewed emphasis on training. For example, a new training oversight committee was convened in 2017 to provide strategic guidance to the department. That effort is now led by new First Deputy Superintendent Tony Riccio. As I understand it, there is a plan in place to get to 40 hours of annual training through a mix of mandatory and elective courses, and the goal is to reach this 40-hour mark by the year 2020. They are building toward that 40-hour mark on a year-by-year basis, and the requirement for this year is 16 hours, and it will increase to 24 hours in 2019. Last year, the department trained every sworn member on a new use of force policy. In conducting the training, the department expanded its capacity for having experienced trainers and created a logistical infrastructure that will be used in future training efforts. The department continues to emphasize procedural justice, critical incident training, and force mitigation, which are centered on de-escalation, and of course, the focus is on also use of force. The training is also moving to a more scenario-based model that better emulates the real-life circumstances that officers face every day. Another important step along the path has been developing a system to identify early intervention tools. The department continues on building a sophisticated predictive tool that will flag officers who exhibit aberrant behavior on an apples-to-apples basis. And what does that mean? It means that once operational, line supervisors will have tools that flag officers who are exhibiting red flags in their conduct, such as an excessive number of citizen complaints, excessive use of medical time, and missing court and so on. Red flags that we know from years of experience in examining data both here and across the nation are predictive of officers who are having difficulty doing their job. Supervisors will be trained to implement a series of progressive interventions with a goal to either get these officers back on track or, in a worst-case scenario, manage them out of the department. This system, unfortunately, is not yet operational, and more on that later. And, of course, reform has to involve transparency. One of the most important parts of reform is that notion of transparency. And again, we have made progress on two fronts. a more timely and complete release of videos and initial police reports related to serious issues of police actions like police-involved shootings or deaths in custody. This is one of the first recommendations of the task force, and we hope then and now that the release of this information on a regular basis would give the public confidence that the department was transparent, and then even when it hurt, it would not, disclosing this information would eliminate the fueling of conspiracy theories born of videos being hidden from public view. And, of course, the department has also expanded the use of body cameras. This is also an important and necessary step towards transparency. Now, these measures and others are real, meaningful progress. No doubt about that. But I'm also here to tell you that, in my view, not enough progress has been made, and that the work that's being done is taking way too long. There remain some real structural, internal and external impediments to the CPD's ability to make real, deep, and lasting reform. Now, in my view, one of the biggest problems for the implementation of real reform revolves around the department's legitimacy. And let me talk about one measure of that. Since 2011, the city has paid out close to $300 million in settlements, judgments, and attorney's fees related to allegations of police misconduct. $300 million. Even if you take out the blockbuster cases regarding wrongful incarceration from years ago, the city is still on pace of a baseline payout between $20 and $30 million every single year. That's breathtaking, right? These annual payouts always exceed the reserves, so the city has to go out into the bond market with its terrible credit rating and borrow money to pay these debts, all while incurring more debt because of the high cost of borrowing in the first place. Now, these numbers are shockingly large and, frankly, unacceptable, but with seemingly no end in sight. Beyond these eye-poppingly large numbers, these dollars represent failure because the payments delegitimize the CPD in the eyes of many citizens. The constant increase suggests that no one is taking this risk seriously. And people now get that their hard-earned dollars are being squandered. People rightfully ask, why should we keep spending money on policing when there is a seeming indifference to addressing this significant risk, which frankly feels more like a certainty than a possibility? Many of you in the audience work or run businesses. Just ask yourself, how long would you keep your job if you had a clear, identified risk that costs tens of millions of dollars every single year and you failed to address it? It wouldn't happen. And yet, in Chicago, this problem persists. We need to know, is anyone asking on a systematic basis, what is driving these underlying cases? Is it a series of rogue police officers? Is it a set of policies that need to be tweaked, changed, or eliminated? Or are these tactical problems that need to be addressed through better or different training? Now, we could think of more questions, but the point is someone, whether it's the mayor, someone within CPD, or the law department, needs to be asking these basic questions. And unfortunately, I have no confidence that that is now happening. This is why it is important that the early intervention system that I mentioned before needs to become operational as soon as possible. But in the interim, this work of flagging and identifying and intervening with problem officers needs to be done in whatever way possible, and it needs to be done now. And these numbers that we're talking about, these multiple hundreds of millions of dollars, they, of course, derive from cases that have been filed. A huge volume of cases pending at any given time in the federal and state courts here in Chicago. And I'm told by my friends who are judges that we have between 400 and 500 of these cases against the city and the police department that dwarfs any other jurisdiction in the country. And to the extent that these cases involve excessive force allegations or deaths against black and brown citizens at the hand of the police, there is, of course, invariably a racial component to the outrage that flows from these dollars. And so these payments in settlements, judgments, and outside attorneys' fees, which are now the subject of intense public scrutiny among activists, news publications, and others, manifest the perfect storm of race, class, and failure to manage risk, and further fuels an erosion of trust with the police department. This glaring problem screams out for resolution and fuels the anger that many citizens feel, particularly those of color, and undermines the efforts that the superintendent and his team have been making over these past 2 years to rebuild trust. Simply put, you cannot be viewed as having legitimacy as long as these numbers keep going up and up, and no one seems to be doing anything about it. Another issue, and another real problem that challenges the legitimacy of the police department, is the abysmal, I'll say it again, the abysmal homicide clearance rate. Some of you were here at the end of January and heard the excellent presentation by Professor Jens Ludwig of the University of Chicago Crime Lab, and he addressed this very point. In 2017 alone, the homicide clearance rate was 17%. Compare that with national averages of like New York or Los Angeles or other large metropolitan areas where that their average clearance rate is 60 and 70%. And if you actually have the audacity to live after being shot, the clearance rate for those violent crimes is in the single digits. This means that if you commit a murder in the city of Chicago, you have an 80% chance of getting away with it. And if the victim has the ability to live, that the percentage increases. And we know in many instances, the people who are the shooters are victimizing people in the same neighborhoods where both victim and shooters live. Imagine knowing that the person who is a demonstrated threat to you and your family and your community walks free in your midst to cause more harm. And let me put this problem in a further context. Folks, we are losing babies and young people every year at an alarming rate. In 2017 alone, 55 children, 18 and under, were lost to gun violence. That number balloons to 171 if we count people 22 and under. And these statistics don't account for the thousands of young people who are shot every year and live. Increasingly, the ability to escape your teens without being victimized has become extremely difficult for kids in certain neighborhoods in the city. We are having a parkland here in Chicago virtually every month, and it has been that way for years. We need to empower our kids to find their voice, and we should not be afraid to speak for them and their families in the midst of this horrible crisis of gun violence. There are all kinds of costs associated with this violence, and the monetary costs, in fact, pale in comparison to the daily harm and human toll that way too many of our fellow Chicagoans endure every day. Because of these grim statistics, the reality is that families in the most crime-plagued neighborhoods must plan for and around violence. Imagine teaching your kids to duck and cover before they even learn their ABCs. Think about whole legions of kids in neighborhoods on the South and the West Sides who cannot access the best that this city has to offer because they are literally pinned down in their homes for fear of violence. In that environment, do you have the luxury to dream? To imagine a life in which you are the hero of your own story, control your own destiny, or where you can conjure up possibilities for yourself and your family that are bigger than you? Do you have the ability to think about your neighbor, or do you live in a constant state of isolation, limitation, fear, without trust or generosity of spirit? Trauma and fear replaces love and hope in such dire circumstances. I have a friend who lost her only child to gun violence. Malcolm was his name. He was 33 years old. He was a father and a former member of the Coast Guard. He was an unintended victim. And how many times do we hear that storyline? My friend did everything she could to raise her son the right way, and she succeeded. So concerned was she about the streets claiming young Malcolm that she used to send him out of state during the summers, down south, so that he could be a child without fear of violence. Malcolm had found love, and he was planning for a marriage to the mother of his child. And then 4 years ago, on Memorial Day weekend, he let a friend talk him into going to a party. When 10 p.m. rolled around, Malcolm decided to leave so that he could get home to his family. And as he walked out of the building where the party was being held, at just that instant, a bullet intended for somebody else claimed him. No one saw the shooter, or so they said, and the case has gone cold. And still, no one has been brought to justice. My friend, as you might imagine, is devastated. Her broken heart will probably never mend. She functions as she must, but the cloud of sadness that surrounds her is palpable. The daily pain that she endures is made worse because she feels like the police have given up and that her son's murderer will never be brought to justice. My friend's story represents the hundreds of stories every single year of individuals and families and neighborhoods in this city devastated by gun violence. That profound pain that they experience is exacerbated each and every day when the people responsible for this violence are not brought to justice. Each of these data points is someone's life that has ended or otherwise been profoundly and irrevocably touched by violence and immeasurable sadness that ripples across their family, their neighborhood, and our city. Please know, the homicide clearance rate is not merely a number. It is a barometer of our values. It speaks to the quality of policing that we allow in this city and our collective value on the sanctity of life. And if we do not demand more accountability and change this important statistic in a positive direction, it will speak volumes about all of us and the kind of community that we choose to live in going forward. And that brings us to another point of connectivity. Even if the CPD solved these and other internal structural problems, this department would still face significant challenges in discharging its daily responsibilities. And why is that? Let me give you another example to illustrate the challenges. As some of you know, last year the mayor announced a decision to build a new police and fire academy. The announced cost is $95 million and is scheduled to be located on the west side in Alderman Emma Mitz Ward near Orr High School. Austin, which is where this new training academy will be located, is one of the poorest and most violent neighborhoods in our city. In Austin, the median income is just $34,000. The unemployment rate ranges from 19 to 28% for ages 20 to 29. 44.6% of the people in Austin are just not in the labor force. And 35% of the households in Austin live on food stamps. From the perspective of many, the plan for the new police academy is flawed. And I share that view. And let me be clear. The Chicago Police Department desperately needs a new training facility. That point is undeniable. But in its current form, the plan is ill-conceived. Putting this edifice to policing in a high-crime, impoverished neighborhood where relations between the police and the community are fraught without a clear plan to engage the community is a mistake. There must also be a plan to use the academy as a community asset. The community should be part of the planning, and in a community that is so asset poor, this facility needs to be accessible to those very community members. And also, the construction of this facility should be part of a larger plan to spur economic development in the Austin neighborhood. Also, where's the rest of the money coming from? To date, less than $10 million has been allocated for the cost of land acquisition. Where are the remaining funds coming from? We don't know yet. But in the context of today's discussion, the allocation of the funds for a police and fire training academy is certainly one that will absolutely exceed $100 million when all is said and done, is viewed by many as a further affirmation that the needs of the people will never be prioritized over those of the police. There is a very determined movement among young people of color and others in this city to stop this academy and make sure that it never becomes a reality. They have organized around a Twitter hashtag, #NoCopAcademy. They have reached out to college campuses across the country. Some of you have seen the news about Harvard and Spelman and UCLA. These kids, young people, they are smart, they are organized, and they are determined. They have been holding teach-ins about the issue in schools, on CTA trains, and they are rallying increasing numbers of people to their cause. And they are not going away, folks. For these young people, every dollar spent on policing is a dollar not spent on the needs in their communities. Needs like good schools, affordable housing, community centers, parks, grocery stores, job training and economic development, the list goes on and on. The basic community anchors and programs that make a difference in the quality of life in a vibrant neighborhood. In this zero-sum game perspective, put bluntly, every dollar spent on the police is another example of disinvestment in these neighborhoods. And that's why this is such a powerful neighborhood narrative. It's a powerful narrative in part because the grim economic statistics of Austin exist in many other neighborhoods in our city. Unemployment and poverty rates that resemble the third world country are common fare just miles away from where we are sitting. And there is a perception that only certain neighborhoods or certain interests get investments, and only certain people matter. It feels like a zero-sum game, but it certainly doesn't have to be. This conflict that I'm outlining is not just an economic divide. It is a divide of hope and possibility. And let me give you another example. Remember in early February, a snowstorm hit the city on a Friday. For my now 10-year-old, it was a joyous occasion because it was a snow day. She put on her snowsuit, went sledding with some neighborhood girls, and when they came in from the cold, they drank hot chocolate and toasted s'mores in our fireplace. It was all very idyllic. But there was another storyline that day that caught my attention. It was just a flicker in the news, but it struck me deeply, particularly when compared to my daughter's experience of that snowy day. There was a story in the news that concerns were raised about the closing of CPS because of the snow, because so many kids depend on the school for their daily meals. For those kids, a snow day had the possibility to be catastrophic, because how would they be fed? This divide represents a crisis. and it is a crisis the police department faces every single day. The manifestation of our neglect of far too many neighborhoods and the absence of a comprehensive plan to address these substantial needs falls heavily on the men and women on the beat every day. These challenges that the police department are not equipped to address, but must be cognizant of these problems because they are so pervasive and they manifest themselves in the many calls for service to which the police are called to respond. For many, the police who interface with people every day are the personification of a government that takes and takes and takes and gives little benefit and in some instances actually harms with seeming impunity. We can never forget that the police department operates in an interconnected ecosystem. In order for that ecosystem to thrive, appropriate attention and nourishment through investments must be given to all of its component parts. That's not happening now. And in my view, unless and until it does, the crisis, actually crises plural, that we face will only deepen. We cannot move forward without moving forward together. If significant sections of our city are left behind, we will eventually all fail. Much more has to be done. Now, in the remaining time that we have together and before your questions, let's talk about some solutions. First, the city needs a comprehensive plan to address the drivers of violence. Such a plan must be based on listening to the needs of the people and making sure that all of the relevant stakeholders have a seat at the table. We have so many resources in this incredible city that must be tapped into. Positive things are actually happening, but it is either too siloed or too small and not brought to scale to make the kind of profound difference that we need. That is why it's critically important for the city to be a catalyst for change. For example, I'm sure you've been reading with great interest about the 600 people who have been recruited to land Amazon's second headquarters. Some of you may be in the room. 600 talented and influential people going all in for an important goal. Now imagine if the mayor and the governor convened a similar set of people focused on solving some of the root causes of crime and violence. Imagine if the best and the brightest of this city united in a common purpose to address this crisis. I hope that we win the Amazon Derby, but I'm also painfully aware that many of the people who need those jobs the most will be ill-equipped to get them because of a lack of investment in their basic education, job skills, or because they have too many barriers for ex-offenders to start anew and not become yet another recidivism statistics. We need leadership and a comprehensive plan to address these challenges as well. Now for CPD, I frankly think the most expedient path is to get the consent decree done so the department can move forward with a specific charge for reform. I have a great deal of respect for our current state attorney general. I think it took great courage for her to wade into these difficult and complicated waters. But time is wasting. There are two comprehensive reports which identified the challenges in bold relief and offered extensive prescriptions for change and reform. It's time to get it done. Give the superintendent the tools that he needs to really drive comprehensive change without further delay. And while many of the challenges that we've covered today cannot be solved by CPD or law enforcement alone, CPD needs to be operating at full capacity. It must continue the hard work of facing hard truths about itself, avoiding the instinct to do nothing in the face of real and obvious problems, and not shrink from the responsibility of calling out those in its ranks who have brought dishonor and have forfeited the right to be police officers. Solving crimes and creating real public safety requires building trust and building relationships, requires training in constitutional policing and a recognition that the community and having the community on your side is just as important, if not more so, than your gun and your badge. It requires legitimacy. All these efforts are linked together, and we cannot fight the violence without building up the department and simultaneously strengthening the community through investments and trust and engagement. And what about the rest of us? As I said, there are good people of will all over this city who are doing the Lord's work, no matter how challenged the environment. We need to identify that work, shine a light on it, take the best ideas, and bring them to scale to replicate them elsewhere across the city. Now, I've spoken to you at length today not to bash the police department. Quite the contrary. I worked for the police department. I care deeply about its success, but I also care deeply about the success of the kids who know and grow to accept a sense of fear and violence in their earliest years, a violence that envelops them like a blanket, a violence that becomes the primary organizing tool in their young lives. We cannot have our children being indoctrinated in this environment of fear that robs them of so much. We simply can't afford to have another generation of mostly black and brown kids literally robbed of their childhood, or worse, their lives, because of raging and out-of-control violence. There is a path forward, but it will take a recognition of the multiple facets of these complicated and interconnected problems. It takes a willingness to face them without a guarantee of political success, and a commitment to listening and engaging. The path is not going to be easy or comfortable, as many of you in the room well know, given your daily responsibilities. But in my view, it is essential for us to take these steps if we truly want to move forward. I speak to you today with a strong sense of passion, and to hopefully ignite in you a sense of urgency, a call to action, an urgency that will not go away, and that I hope, frankly, keeps you up at night like it does to me, a sense of urgency that will drive you to ask yourself as you sit here and as you leave here today, what can I do to make a difference? What can I do to demand of the policymakers and the elected officials and the appointed officials accountability on these big challenges that we are facing every single day? And I hope it gives you a sense of urgency to demand that as a community, we chart a different course together. Thank you. Good. Only one question.
Oh, no. We have several for you, Lori. First of all, thank you for that address. That was absolutely thought-provoking, irritating at times, very revealing at times. It's everything that we could ask for in a city club luncheon. Now that I have my glasses, we can get to the questions. Okay. So, this is from Graham Grady with Taft Law, City Club member. Should the Chicago Police Department become certified? Then he has a background. When former Superintendent McCarthy first arrived in Chicago, he pledged to get CPD certified. It never came to pass. Would certification help? And I already heard someone say, what would certified mean?
Well, I think what you're asking, Graham, is, and to give context, there's no national standards for policing. There are some things that are written into the state statutes, but you can't go from one jurisdiction to the other and have an assurance that police officers have the same training, are required to do the same thing. So this is a constant topic of conversation. And particularly over the last 2 years here in Chicago. But I doubt that there's going to be a real robust national effort because everybody feels like their police departments are unique. I hope that we get to a point, frankly, in the state of Illinois that we raise our standards on some of the basic issues. But I don't see there being a national certification like, frankly, there are with lawyers or even hairdressers in some instance, but not police.
Okay, thank you. This is from City Club member Randall Blakey, who's with the LaSalle Street Church. While there are many advocacy organizations working on police reform, what do you think is the foremost issue that we should be targeting here in Chicago?
Well, on the reform front, as I said, I think training is fundamental. We have got to think more, I think, granularly about how we train, and I'll give you one example that some of you have heard me talk about. Unfortunately, we live in one of the most segregated cities in the country. We recruit from those segregated neighborhoods. So in many instances, you see recruit classes populated with young people who have never viewed somebody different than them as a peer before. If you go to the police academy, and frankly, whether it's a recruit class or a promotion class, they self-segregate by race. That speaks volumes about one of the challenges I think that the police department has. Now, there have been some steps taken at the recruit level. For example, there was a program that started last year to take recruits to the DeSabo Museum. But I think that there's got to be more done. And one thing that I've been advocating for, and I'll say it again because I think there's somebody in the room that might have the ability to make a difference, in New York, before those police recruits go out to their initial assignments, they spend their last 2 weeks in the districts or in the locations that they're going to be assigned to, and they meet community ambassadors. That's really important for a number of reasons. It demystifies these neighborhoods that the young recruits may know nothing about, particularly when they're going on the midnight shift, which, again, is something we have got to stop. You don't send the youngest, greenest people out on the midnight shift in the most dangerous neighborhoods in the city. It makes no sense, but that's part of the vagaries of the union contract. But what happens in New York is they go out, they meet people who are ambassadors in neighborhoods, they recognize that there are people of goodwill in those neighborhoods, and based on my conversations with folks in NYPD, it makes a world of difference. We need to do that here in Chicago, and I think it would really put us on a very different path from the start of a police officer's life.
Thank you. This is from City Club member Theodore Manuel. You might recognize the name, but he left the Z out. Theodore Z. Manuel, frequent contributor to the letters to the editor and Sun-Times and Tribune. Ted's question is, name the inadequacies in weeding out police recruits for psychological danger signs early in the selection process, for tendencies towards ignoring the rules, withholding critical information, racist tendencies, being trigger happy, etc.
Well, again, I think we have to be very thoughtful about the way in which we recruit. And frankly, I think we've got to do a much better job. I think there was an article in the papers recently about the fact that despite the significant effort being made to recruit a very diverse applicant pool, we're not seeing that same yield when it comes time for those folks to step up and go into the academy. And that's a problem. And I think that process has got to be solved. I think it still comes down to training. And we just have to put the elephant on the table, and that's race. The fact that people don't know each other, that we grow up in the city not seeing people who are different than us as peers, is a real issue and a challenge that the police department has to face. And then once we train them the right way, we need to make sure that we continue to support those officers once they get out on the beat. We've made some progress in the field training officer program. We can't allow that program to wither on the vine again. But we need to make sure that when there are problems, we are flagging them at the earliest stage. That's why I talked before about the early intervention program. Right now, supervisors have to go on their gut instinct. And they face the same institutional and cultural fears about flagging people who are not good employees, who are not fit for duty. You go to any unit, any beat, they're going to tell you who the dogs are. They know who the people who are the problems, and yet there is a difficulty in flagging them and addressing that for the same reasons that we all have concerns in our own institutions about raising our hand and saying, you know what, so-and-so is not fit. So-and-so is doing things that are wrong and that are harmful to the institution. The police department is no different, but the difference is that if those issues are not addressed, it has the potential to have deadly consequences.
Very good. Okay. This is from City Club member Dan Gibbons. Are you involved with or are you able to comment on the status of the police contract?
I wish I was able to comment on the status of the police contract, but the truth is, despite the fact that there's been a tremendous amount of attention paid to changing some of the structural problems within these police contracts, there's been virtually nothing about what the negotiation process is in the news. Now, don't get me wrong. Nobody expects the mayor and his team to negotiate the police contracts in the media. That makes no sense, of course. But what I've said and others have argued is that we need to understand what the value statement is that is going into and informing those negotiations. The police contracts since the Jane Byrne administration have really just been treated like an everyday transaction. Well, they're not. All of those contracts, whether it's police, fire, or the laborers that dig the ditches, there are value statements in those contracts, and that is particularly so when it comes to the police department. So I hope that we will have a better sense in the coming days of what values and mandate that the mayor and his team have given to the negotiators as they enter into negotiations with the FOP. I was discouraged to hear recently, I think Kevin Graham, the president of the FOP, said they'd only met once. The contract expired in June 30th of last year. So you can take odds on whether or not those contracts will be resolved before February of 19. I suspect not. But we should know, and there should be some transparency around the key issues and drivers for the city. Because God help us that, you know, after the election next year, a package of contracts is presented to the city council that no one has had any visibility into. That day has come and has passed, and we need more transparency around the contracts.
No beating around the bush with you. Okay, a couple really interesting questions left for us. This is from, I apologize, I'm probably going to butcher your last name, Donna Kapchi. Close? Okay, good. Is there any chance that the proposal for a citizens' oversight board will be accepted by the city council? Did it go too far? Is there room for compromise?
So I told myself I wasn't going to wade into these waters today, but it's not to be. Look, the GAPA, the Grassroots Alliance for Police Accountability, is a group of neighborhood organizations that really took up the call that was left by the Police Accountability Task Force, which was to create an overarching civilian oversight body to have oversight over the police department, the police board, and now COPA. I think that's important. It's important in this city, in this time, that individual citizens feel like they have a vote and that they have a way to affect the trajectory of policing in this city. It doesn't mean that citizens off the streets without any training are going to be telling the police superintendent how to staff the various districts, what resources to deploy. But what it does mean is that people in this city want a vote and want a voice over one of the most important institutions in the city, and certainly one that their hard-earned tax dollars are going to fund, both from an operational standpoint and in the settlements and judgments that we talked about. That we live in a time where people don't have confidence that the current status quo works for them. And in fact, I think people would say that they've rejected that status quo. So I view the GAPA proposal as the start of an important conversation. But clearly, and hopefully, it'll see some legislative light of day, and it will go through a process of negotiation. But the conversation is one that must be had.
Okay, we have time for two last questions. They're both very interesting. This is from Stan Hill with Information Public Sector. What would happen if the CPD required officers to carry their own personal accident insurance, similar to doctors, lawyers, taxi drivers? When you tie risk back to individual pay, it's a powerful tool for changing human behavior.
Indeed. That is a proposal that has been talked about. It's not been taken up. But I think the larger point from your question is CPD has to have some skin in the game. The huge numbers that we talked about, they don't come out of CPD's budget. And now I think that's a problem. I don't know about the concept of actually making individual officers pay for insurance. Frankly, the way that collective bargaining goes in the city, you're going to be paying for that if that's imposed upon them, because it'll be a line item in the contract. But the concept is right, that we have to get to a place where individual officers feel a responsibility to make sure that they are doing their job in the right way. And I think they do, but also to ensure, right, that their colleagues are also doing their job in the right way. This is a concept that I think has become in vogue from national policing organizations, the duty to intervene. And that's where we need to get to, that it doesn't feel like you're the narc, that you're breaking the code of silence, but that you recognize a need to protect the integrity and legitimacy of the organization, and that compels you to take action, whether it's about yourself or about a colleague.
Okay, thank you. Time for one last quick question. This is from Roosevelt University trustee Charlie Gardner, who wants to remind everybody the Joffrey Ballet will be here in April. He expects to see everyone here attending. This is his question. Do TV shows like Chicago PD and Chi have any impact on CPD, their morale, their tactics, their image? You didn't know you were going to be a queen.
Yeah, it feels like Richard Roper should be here. I don't really know the answer to that question, right? I mean, all of us in all of our professions want to be portrayed in the most positive light. But the reality is policing is a very tough job. They face huge challenges every single day. They're getting their hands dirty. They're wrestling on the ground, literally wrestling on the ground with folks. So I think what each of us would want, and I would imagine police officers would be the same, is a fair shake, a fair portrayal of the challenges, the good and the bad. And I think if we do that, and we do separate fact from fiction, I think that they will be well served. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's give Laurie a big hand.